microphone. We are very honored to have with us tonight Dr. John Harris, who is a PhD philosopher at TCU. He actually was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and went to New Mexico State for his undergraduate studies, then got his PhD from the University of Colorado. And after that, he taught a year at SMU, and then accepted a permanent position at TCU in 2007. His interests focus primarily on political philosophy, applied ethics, ethics of law, the philosophy of law, and most recently has been working on the problem of causal impotence. I'm going to let him explain what that is. He is married to his wife, Tracy, who couldn't be with us tonight, I'm sorry to say. They have an embarrassing number of cats. And I asked John, well, how many cats do you have? He said, well, 44, but less, not quite that many. Only, what, four?
Four.
That's right. Four cats. And they kind of run him and his and Tracy's life, I understand. And he said he's also a fan of the Chicago Cubs. I said, how in the world, what's that relationship? Well, his parents, I think, came from Chicago. Were you born in Chicago?
No, I'm first generation.
Oh, you were born actually in New Mexico. Okay. All right. Well, John is going to talk to us tonight about statutes of limitations and why they should be limited. limit the statutes of limitations. First of all, let me say a little bit about the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We've been doing this for 30-plus years, and we have distinguished speakers, academicians, for the most part, and not just about philosophy, and of course I'm speaking to the choir here, but in fact, I see mostly familiar faces. Are there any visitors for the first time? No. Okay, fine. Well, you know about what we talk about. And so, let's see. The topic's coming up. The next, October the 25th, growing a new generation of social justice activists and agitators. November the 8th. This is the one that got my interest. Are the size and age of the universe evidence against the existence of God? That's going to be good. November the 22nd, minds, machines, and morality, ethical realms of artificial intelligence. And December the 13th, religion in the process. So, as you know, pay your bill, take care of your white person, and pay our treasurer, for your entrance fee because we have expenses that we have to take care of too. So anyway, let's dispense with all of the trivial talk and have our speaker, Dr. John Harris.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really excited to be here. And I was looking over the calendar, and it really seems like an impressive lineup. And impressive. In fact, I thought the age and size of the universe as an argument against God's existence. I'm fascinated to know how that argument might go. So, yeah. So, as a matter of fact, looking at the schedule, all the topics seemed great. Probably embarrassingly enough, with the exception of my own talk. So I was thinking, like, wow, this is tough competition. So I appreciate all of you showing up tonight anyway. And I also have to say, since I'm a Cubs fan, I'm much happier to be here with you right now than watching the Cubs sort of embarrass me once again. So this is, even if this winds up being an incredibly embarrassing talk for me, at least it's better than watching the Cubs. So, all right, so I was actually mentioning to you my dinner partners tonight. The motivation or how I got interested in this topic is I happened to watch a documentary about the Central Park Five, which maybe many of you remember, but a case from 1989 where there was an attack in Central Park. A jogger was going through Central Park. She was assaulted, viciously raped, and really left to die. Five young men were picked up in the park who had been harassing other people in the park, and very quickly the police sort of zeroed in once they found out about the assault, sort of liked these five young men for the crime itself. So all of these young men were young teenagers, maybe 16 or 17. They were questioned without their parents or lawyers present, and eventually many of them confessed to having committed the crime. What we know now, unfortunately, though, is that they did not commit the crime. In 2002, someone confessed to the crime, and as a matter of fact, there was DNA evidence that confirmed that, as a matter of fact, the person who confessed committed the crime. Now, what strikes me as very interesting about this case is that there's injustices that abound. I mean, this is sort of a case that's rich with injustices. But what struck me as particularly sort of shocking is that the person who actually committed the crime, who confessed to the crime, the documentary reveals to you, he could not be prosecuted because the statute of limitations had run. So it's just simply too late for to prosecute this person. So essentially he could say, yeah, I committed it. And there's nothing we as a society could do about that. And that struck me as really odd. So I started thinking about, why do we have statute of limitations? What is the service or the point of this? And so I've come to believe, and perhaps you can convince me that I'm wrong about this, that at least with respect to violent crimes, we should not have statute of limitations. So I'm going to try and suggest that, as a matter of fact, as the thesis states here, that they are unjust, they are unjustified, and they are unnecessary. I really, as I was working on the handout, I really wanted to try and get some alliteration there. I had unjust, unjustified, and then I was just going to add unjust, unnecessary or something, but I just couldn't make it happen, but I promise you I worked on that. So, all right. So that's the rough motivation and where we're going to go with the talk. So there are just some preliminaries, right? So statutes of limitations, just roughly speaking, sort of set a time bar for when an action can be brought by a plaintiff, right? So there are statutes of limitations in various aspects of the law. I'm focusing in on criminal justice here, but, and so there's interesting questions about when you can bring tort claims or these other sorts of. That's not what interests me. I'm really interested merely in the criminal aspect of statutes of limitations. Another thing to keep in mind is that there's not really one set of statutes of limitations in the United States. They vary widely from state to state. So that's sort of a benchmark. I'm using the Model Penal Code and their statement about statutes of limitations. And so roughly for felonies, the statute of limitations in the Model Penal Code is anywhere from 3 to 6 years, right? So first degree felonies, the sort of worst kinds of felonies, 6 year statute of limitations, sort of lesser felonies, 3 years. Right? And so that would be the rough, the outline. There are some attorneys in the room, so I'll just mention briefly. There are some sorts of things that sort of affect statute of limitations. So sometimes you might think of the clock being stopped on the statute of limitations. This is called tolling. Right, so for example, with a lot of, and sorry, this is so depressing for dinner conversation, but for sexual assault cases against children, typically most laws say that the statute of limitations doesn't begin until the victim turns 18. Right, so that's tolling. Right, so it's not as if the years as a minor count against bringing a case against your assaulter. It's only once you turn 18. So that would be an example with the clock stopping. If I were to steal something from you and I figure out you got evidence against me, it's not like I can leave the country for 6 years and come back and say, too late, right? So by fleeing, sort of we stop the clock. So for present purpose, I'm going to set issues about tolling aside and just kind of take statute of limitations on its face, right? That, there are these cases like the Central Park Five, like Trisha Mealy, who's the victim in the Central Park assault case. Bill Cosby is now, many of his victims can't bring him to trial because of statute of limitations. A lot of people are concerned about that, right? So there are a lot of these cases where it seems like, as a matter of fact, statute of limitations prevents us from going after people legally. And so I want to say, explore the idea, what makes sense of that? Okay, so the first step is to just say, to argue that the statutes of limitations are unjust. And so this is sort of, I'll be perfectly honest with you, a little bit of a philosopher's trick, because it makes my claim sound glorious and bold and amazing, when in fact, I'm going to do something, so I'm going to define justice as a very narrow idea. So here I just mean, when we think about what sorts of justifications we have for criminal punishment, I think whatever theory you have on offer for criminal punishment that justifies punishment are going to be at odds with statute of limitations. So so what I want to do is just run through what I take to be the two sort of major lines of argument regarding criminal punishment and show why both lines of argument fail to justify statute of limitations. Right? So on one side, on one end of the spectrum of justifying punishment, right? So, and just to give the question about justifying punishment, it does seem slightly odd that for the most part, say, while we're having dinner tonight, you say, well, John, tell me what you'd like to do with your spare time. And I say, well, I'd like to lock people up in my basement and then give them mediocre food and cable television and then maybe let them exercise in my backyard for an hour a day. I think you would rightly be outraged, right? So that's insane. I can't believe you do that, right? But as a matter of fact, we do this to people as a society all the time, right? So why is it all right for us to do this down in Huntsville, say, but not in my basement, right? So what is it that justifies us doing things that typically are morally impermissible, right? So one answer is the retributivist answer, right? So what justifies us in treating people in these ways that are normally forbidden is really what the individual deserves. So punishment is justified based upon the desert of the offender, right? So because you've done something wrong, right, just in virtue of that fact justifies us now inflicting some sort of pain or penalty upon you. All right, but to start thinking about this a bit more clearly, I do want to look at two different versions of retributivism. So what does it mean to say that somebody deserves punishment? So there's two, broadly speaking, views on this that retributivists have offered. So on your handout, you can see one is the forfeiture-based view. And so this is the idea that when I commit a crime, essentially I forfeit my, certain rights that I once held, right? So sometimes it's stated, so essentially, like, if I steal something from you, I essentially lose property rights, right? So if I take money from you, the state can come along and then financially penalize me as a result, and that's, I have no grounds for complaint because I forfeited that right until I, made you whole again or something. Sometimes it's sort of you lose the exact right that you violated. And so often, like, these forfeiture accounts are used to justify things like capital punishment, right? So the reason why the state is justified taking a person's life is because if you took, you took another person's life, and so you essentially forfeited your right to life. It gets very awkward very quickly, for things like, say, there's an arsonist, right? I mean, what are we supposed to do with an arsonist? So it's like the state going to go burn your house down or something, right? So that, the reason why you have something like you surrender that right or some sort of comparable set of rights is they say, okay, well, we're not going to burn your house down or something like that because we don't really want the state getting into the business of arson, or so we just want to stay out of that. So instead, that is that, well, if you didn't forfeit your right to not have your house burned down, what you did is forfeit your right to live freely for some period of time. You forfeited, and your criminal act forfeits this right to be free. So then the question is, on the forfeiture-based view, can we justify statutes of limitations? And I still think, even on this view, it doesn't seem clearly true that we can. We can try and think of some examples here where this would make sense, but we may just think, after some period of time, your forfeiture stops, right? So let's say, just following again the model penal code, after 6 years, the state can't go after you anymore, right? So your rights sort of rehabilitate themselves on their own. But I think this sort of has really, very odd implications, right? So imagine, for example, Jones assaults Smith, and violently assaults Smith. But we can't quite figure out who actually committed this crime against Smith until 5 years and 364 days after the crime. Now, we're inclined to punish Jones for this assault against Smith, right? But here's something we also know. After six years after committing the crime, Jones's rights rehabilitate on their own, punishment or not, right? At least if we're trying to make sense of statutes of limitations on this view. So if Jones only lacks his right not to be punished for 1 day longer, it seems like the implication of this view is that, according to the statute of limitations argument, we would really only be justified punishing Jones for one more day, right? Because at the six-year point, his right not to be punished sort of magically comes back into existence, right? So this seems like an implausible view to me, right? I think it does invite sort of a very natural response. One might say, well, no. It's not that you only get to punish in that, you know, for that six-year window. It's just we've got to try to figure out and apply the punishment in that six-year window. So let's say, for example, that we do figure out that it's Jones who committed the assault. On day on the fifth year, 364th day, we impose a five-year penalty on Jones. Then after Jones serves that five-year penalty, that five-year prison term, then after that, will release Jones, right? Now, I think that does seem like a very natural response to what I've said, right? But I'm inclined to ask, why is it that we're justified to impose that five-year penalty at 5 years and 364 days? And I think the most plausible answer here is, well, we're justified in doing that because that act, that punishing act, is what really rehabilitates Jones' rights. It's not being 6 years out from the crime that rehabilitates Jones' rights. It's being held account for what Jones did wrong. Now, if you have my intuition that that's really the explanation here, then again, it looks like statute of limitations can't really make any sense, right? It's the punishment that justifies the rehabilitation of the rights, not merely timing, right? So if we discover it was Jones who committed the crime after 6 years and 1 day, I'm inclined to think, well, we should still justify that individual because the time since the crime has passed doesn't rehabilitate Jones. It's really only being held accountable for the crime. So it doesn't look to me like the forfeiture-based account really has the ability or the tools to justify a statute of limitations. So if you're drawn towards the forfeiture view, I think you should agree with me that statutes of limitations are unjustified, at least with respect to violent crimes. So we can also consider another version of retributivism. This is on your handout. This is fairness-based retributivism, right? So again, this is the idea that sometimes when somebody commits a crime, this is unjustifiable or is wrong because they've taken unfair advantage, right? They're expecting others to obey the rules, but they're taking advantage of that rule abidingness that the rest of us engage in so that they can get an unfair advantage, right? As a result, punishment is justified as a means of sort of balancing the scales, right? So making sure that there's not this unfair disadvantage, this disparity in like one person playing by the rules and the other one breaking the rules. We impose extra heavy costs on the rule breaker to sort of balance things out so somebody doesn't have an unfair advantage over the other. All right, so then the question is, can we use this sort of idea that punishment is justified by an unfair advantage to explain statutes of limitations? So maybe something like the idea is that if you get an unfair advantage, the longer we move out from that advantage, the more we think that the unfair disadvantage sort of fades, right? So maybe right after the crime, I've really gained some sort of incredible advantage over you, right? So I go to the local 7-Eleven, and I steal a pack of gum, right? So then for the next week, I've got fresh, minty breath, and I'm, feeling very confident about myself. But then, soon thereafter, right, the benefits no longer accrue, right? Nobody's talking about my fresh breath anymore, and so I'm not impressing anyone any longer. And so 6 years on, it's just hard to believe that anybody even remembers it. The benefit is gone, the benefit is faded, so too the needs to balance out the scales, right? So maybe that's a way that the fairness-based account can justify statutes of limitations, is that these unfair advantages just don't last that long. They don't have long-standing repercussions in life. Now, I think that's a potential way to justify not punishing if this is your view of how we solve the problem of punishment. But what I think this fails to do is justify a statute of limitations. And so, and this is sort of a theme that you'll hear throughout, is that really, can we justify the principled claim that we shouldn't punish anyone after 6 years based upon this? And I don't think that's obviously true, because it seems to me there could be some crimes where, as a matter of fact, unfair benefits sort of get more intense over time, right? So I can, you know, so here's two examples, right? So again, my main interest is in violent crime, but I'll use an example, property crime, just to illustrate the fact that unfair advantages can get more intense over time rather than less. Imagine I steal a painting from you, right? At the time, it's a nice painting, but not really worth that much. Then the artist who produced the painting that I stole from you dies, and I'm sure, as all of you know, once the artists who produce paintings die, value skyrockets as a result, right? And so 6 years after I've stolen the painting from you, the artist who produced the painting dies, and now this is a much more valuable painting, right? And so, as a matter of fact, the advantages that I've gained have intensified over time rather than dissipated, right? But we might think, like with violent crimes, if Jones assaults Smith and Smith is left permanently disabled, right, or continues to have ever worsening health problems as a result of this assault, it doesn't seem that the unfair advantage dissipates in that case. Rather, the unfair advantage continues to have repercussions through Smith's life, and Jones has gained an unfair advantage. So again, I think in that case, we should absolutely think that even 7 years after the crime has been committed, we shouldn't say, well, all of the effects have essentially dissipated off into the universe. I think we would rightly say, no, Jones should be held account, even though this is well after the crime has been committed. And I think that's justified by the very view on offer. Again, the fairness-based theory of retributivism says, don't let people just benefit from unfair advantages. And this seems like an unfair advantage, and I don't think, in principle, the unfair advantage stops after 6 years. All right. I had a slight concern coming into the talk tonight that I had a lot of material that I was trying to move through somewhat quickly. Am I going too fast, or is everybody... Okay, all right, good. So then let's consider deterrence. As I mentioned at the bottom of this, is I think just any theory of retributivism is going to have problems with statutes of limitations, right? So as long as you say what's justifying punishment is desert, there's going to be I'm going to be able to generate odd or uncomfortable cases for you where I say, look, it looks like this individual's done something horrible and they deserve to be held account for that. And that seems true at 5 years and 364 days, seems just as true at 6 years and 1 day, right? And so it's really, so I can, I'm going to be able to press that objection against anyone who wants to focus on desert being the justification of punishment. It just seems there's going to be a very difficult story to tell that justifies that very bright line distinction between punishing on one side and not punishing on the other. And so I think all theories of retributivism are going to have problems with statutes of limitations. But let's consider deterrence. So deterrence instead says, well, actually what justifies punishment is its ability to prevent future crimes, right? So retributivism is backwards looking. What interests us is what took place in the past. What have you done will answer the question whether or not you deserve punishment or not. Deterrence, on the other hand, seems to be forward-looking. It says, well, if we punish, what sorts of crimes can we prevent down the road? Right? And so surely I think both of you should sound somewhat familiar to us in society. I think you hear people appealing to these kinds of things all the time. Right? So on one hand, this person just deserves to be punished. Right? They deserve to be held accountable. And then on the other hand, part of the reason why we want to, arguments, I think, quite commonly for the death penalty, capital punishment, are appealing to its ability to prevent future murders, to stop this sort of thing from happening again, right? So let's look at deterrence. I think there's three common ways that punishment is taken to deter crimes. One, is that by locking somebody up literally for whatever period of time, they can't commit crimes, right? So I have this sort of side note, run with me here, right? Because, let's be honest, crime continues to take place in prisons, right? So prisons aren't necessarily a bastion of crime-free behavior, but we might still at least the sort of crime is restricted to, this certain populace, right? It's not crime committed out here in the streets of Dallas. It's crime committed within the walls, amongst thieves and murderers and the like, right? And so I may find out that Charles Manson is up to no good, right? But as long as Charles Manson is up to no good in prison, I feel like, well, okay. As long as, he's up to no good with his fellow evil Californians, I'm all right with it, right? So as long as the crime at least that's available to them is restricted. Right? Another way that punishment is taken to deter crime is that it teaches the criminal a lesson, right? It essentially makes crime a bad bargain. So after you've committed this crime, you realize, look, I wanted to rob that bank. I robbed the bank, I had money for a few days, but then the police caught me and now I spent all these years in prison. That wasn't worth it, right? And I even had to give the money back, right? So there just was no upside to robbing banks. Gonna turn my life around and not do this anymore, right? So it teaches the criminal a lesson such that he or she shouldn't engage in that behavior anymore. And then also finally just sends a message to the rest of society. Hey, those of you thinking about engaging in similar behavior, don't do it. Again, it's a bad bargain. Look what we did to Jones over there, right? We locked Jones up for a long period of time. You shouldn't be like Jones. All right. So the question then is, does deterrence give us the tools we need in order to justify statutes of limitations? And I think, again, the answer is no here, right? One thing is, we can just see that, we can imagine cases where an individual has gone unpunished, right? And so, as a matter of fact, for the period of time since their initial crime, right? So Jones has been my lawbreaker throughout the talk tonight, so let's say Jones has committed some horrible crime, and he's been free for the past 7 years to continue doing that kind of horrible crime. Let's say Jones assaults people, right? So he beats people up, and that's what he likes to do for fun. And Jones has continued to do it for the past 7 years, right? So Jones has not been restricted in his behavior at all. Further, Jones has never been taught a lesson about beating people up, and so he continues to do it. And then finally, because Jones hasn't been held account for this behavior, we haven't been able to send a message to other like-minded individuals, hey, don't beat innocent people up, right? Or it's a bad bargain to do that, even if you find that very fun. You shouldn't do it. You should find different hobbies, right? Take up smoking or something, right? Even anything would be less harmful than beating people up for fun. So it looks like, in that case, no matter what our sort of preferred reading or preferred form of deterrence comes in, sending a message to the individual, teaching that individual a lesson, or teaching society a lesson, there are problems that lurk here, because it seems surely we can imagine a case where even after 7 years after the crime, we may want to restrict that individual's ability to continue engaging in crimes like the one that they had performed in the past, that we want to teach that person a lesson not to do that sort of thing again. Again, even 7 years after the crime, we may still want to teach them this lesson. And then finally, we may still want to send a message to the rest of society that people should engage in these kinds of behaviors, right? So it just looks like, again, the deterrence there's not going to have the tools available to it to justify having a statute of limitations, right? Having a rule that says at 6 years you can't punish people for violent felonies anymore, right? Because it seems like, again, if our interest is deterrence, we'll have deterrent interests that sometimes extend beyond 6 years. So I did want to mention sort of one very interesting version of this argument, version of deterrence here. So it's under C, this subsection 3. So one particular argument is, look, so we can sort of construct a dilemma here, right? We say, look, and I'll just recreate what you have on the handout here. Either the criminal's learned his lesson or he hasn't, right? So if he's learned his lesson since committing the crime 7 years ago, we don't need to punish him. Lesson's been learned, right? So it's sort of pointless, right? If the individual hasn't learned the lesson, well, what does that mean, Well, it likely means they've been committing that crime over and over again in the meantime, right? But that means if they've been committing the crime over and over again in the meantime, we've got more recent, let's say, for lack of a better word, fresher examples of this crime available to us, right? And so why not just appeal to those, right? So even if the crime had happened 7 years ago, right, if they did learn their lesson, well, they've stopped doing it, and we don't need to punish them. Punishment is justified in deterring future crimes. They're not doing this anymore. We can stop. Or if they've continued to do it, hey, we've got much more recent examples. Something happened last week, and we can go ahead and hold them accountable for that. We don't need to reach 7 years back into the past, right? So that actually looks like a deterrence-based argument that justifies statutes of limitations. So that's sort of a promising possibility here. But unfortunately, I don't think this justifies, again, the statute of limitations, right? Because you can easily construct examples where, let's say, our criminal became more and more sophisticated over time. So even though the individual's continued to engage in this practice, he or she's gotten much better over time at hiding this nefarious activity that they've been up to, right? So as a matter of fact, the best evidence we have of them committing this crime is much older, right? And so in those sorts of cases, which doesn't seem fantastical to me, we would be justified in punishing them for the much the crime that had occurred much further in the past, right? As long as we have good evidence for it, right? So even still here, it seems like deterrence can't justify statutes of limitations. We might say, yeah, if you have much better, much more recent evidence, go with that. But if you don't, and on the other hand, you have evidence from 7 years ago that certainly justifies that they've engaged in criminal behavior and could be held up in a court of law, then I see no reason not to go with that. Again, if our point is deterrence, the 7-year-old crime is just as capable of deterring as the two-week-old crime. All right, so let me just say on one last issue about statutes of limitations and justice. These deterrence and retributivism are the two most common justifications for punishment, but they're by no means the only ones. But I think even on sort of non-standard theories of justification, so some people think the point of punishment, so essentially punishment abolitionist thing, you know, so some argue for restorative justice or things like reconciliation. Here you might think of like how South Africa dealt with, you know, the problems of apartheid is to just have people come forward and sort of like admit to the horrors and the things and like sort of come and confess the wrongness. Some people advocate sort of a system of, and they wouldn't want to call it punishment, sort of reconciliation as a replacement for punishment. Or restitution, where instead of punishing people, we make people make their victim whole again, where we really focus on that relationship between victim and perpetrator. Whatever your sort of non-standard theory of punishment may be, I still think they're going to suffer these problems, right? Because we could still think of cases where restitution is still owed beyond 6 years, right? And so simply because you escaped restoring me for 6 years, it's just hard to believe that thus now you have no obligation to, no obligation of restoration. It's in fact, it's a way of thinking about this, just sort of like thinking about dessert, returning to this, like, retributivism. It seems to me we can sort of like really press this intuition and we think of like non-nefarious people, but actually think of do-gooders, right? And like whether or not dessert stops at 6 years in cases do-gooding or kindly deeds, right? So imagine my cats set my house on fire and my wife and I are overwhelmed by smoke, but some heroic passerby sees smoke pouring out of my house and they break into the home, they pull my wife and I out. They even save our cats, which I'm not sure I'm grateful about that, but I don't know who rescued us, right? It's just some sort of, you know, they said, he had a cape and all kinds of gadgets on his belt, and his head seemed to be pointy, but I never got a good look at him. And then he went whisking off, right? I go, oh, wow, you know, I really would love to thank this guy. And so then suppose 7 years hence, Bruce Wayne comes along and says, you know what, the Wayne Manor's falling apart, I could really use some help, you know, I'm desperate, I need some help repairing. I was hoping you would, you know, think about helping me out, John, because I was the guy who came and saved you and your wife 7 years ago when there was that house fire. It was me who did that. I think it would be an utterly odd response for me to say, yeah, but that was 7 years ago, man. Statute of limitations ran. I have no reason to be to be thankful for or grateful for the good things you did to me, right? And so surely if we think Thanks is deserved or is owed even beyond 6 years. We may also think punishment can be owed or deserved 6 years and beyond, right? So I think there's certainly with the statute of limitations an asymmetry there, and the best way to get rid of that asymmetry is just get rid of the statute of limitations. All right, so I'll quickly, last few points. So if we can't appeal to sort of theories of justice about the nature of punishment, maybe we can sort of look at maybe more pragmatic reasons or epistemological reasons to justify statute of limitations. Maybe even here, I think we're going to have problems. So I'll move through these somewhat quickly, right? So one possibility is that this sort of protects us from malicious prosecution, right? We may worry that there's going to be nefarious prosecutors who dangle the threat of prosecution from long past crimes over someone's head. So we may say, well, this sort of protects us from those evils, right? I'll be honest with you, this sort of concern just doesn't move me at all, right? I mean, because if like part of the premise of the objection here is that we have a nefarious or evil prosecutor, I'm not sure that the statute of limitations is really the only thing that's keeping their evilness at bay, right? I mean, so if they're inclined to sort of misuse their power in the case, you know, in sort of a world without statutes of limitations, they may also be perfectly happy to misuse their power in a world with statutes of limitations. So I think in that case, the problem is not the presence or lack of statutes of limitations, it's the presence of a evil prosecutor. Right? And so I think this just sort of misdescribes the nature of the problem here. So one thing is that it does seem that in some cases statutes of limitations can protect settled expectations, right? So I do think that this is actually potentially very interesting. So I want to think about like difficult cases, right? Because I think there's some sorts of cases where we just sort of think like, well, you know, you may be sort of comfortable in your life, and so the threat of punishment, you know, years down the road, we may not feel bad for you, right? And so we may think of like someone like Bill Cosby, or maybe if you're still a fan of Bill Cosby, somehow like think about the person from the Central Park 5 case, where, you know, I just personally will never be moved, say like, oh, that was 18 years ago, give the guy a break. I'll say, well, you know, if you want a break, don't commit these heinous sorts of acts, right? But if you do this sort of thing, you have to live with the fact that punishment may come at any time. And so, yeah, I mean, that may be upsetting to you, but my first inclination is to say it's so much the worse for you. But let me try and at least sketch a case where we wind up thinking that the individual really should be protected, right? So think about a case where Jones again assaulted Smith, and it's violent. But this happened when Jones was 18, right? And so Jones had something of a rough and tumble youth, right? But Jones has turned his life around. And so maybe the intervening years of 18 years since then, Jones become a pillar of the community, right? He works at the local animal shelter, you know, he helps orphans, you know, so, and he's got a family, right? And then it's suddenly figured out after all these years that it was Jones who committed the crime. And so we may think, look, now if we punish Jones now, he has this family, and the family may be very much dependent on him. And so we may think, look, at this point, you know, maybe we should move on, right? Maybe it's inappropriate, right? Here's a case where it's settled expectations. We may think, terrible that he did this so long ago. Maybe we think Smith should be able to take him to court and sue for damages. But as far as criminal prosecution, maybe we think too many people depend on him, and he's obviously turned his life around. Punishment's inappropriate here. So I must say I'm moved by my own example there. I think, like, yeah, maybe that's right. Maybe, but I don't think we need statutes of limitations to address that kind of case. There, we already have prosecutorial discretion, right? And so in those sorts of cases, we might say, let's hand it over to the prosecutor and say, like, use this power wisely, right? Don't just go after anybody because you can, right? We want to have prosecutors who pursue cases, like pursue genuinely bad people. Maybe Jones isn't that kind of person, or maybe we find sort of alternative ways, right? Maybe we insist that Jones engage in some restorative activities with Smith, right? Help Smith out in some way or some form to make Smith whole again, but again, not destroy Jones's life, right? So maybe in that sort of case, prosecutorial discretion does all the work that we need it to. And so even sort of the best case of settled expectations, I don't think we need statutes of limitations to protect us from the dangers there. We just need wise prosecutors. Now, if the question is how do we get wise prosecutors, that's a different talk. So I don't know how to do that, but I think it is a way of answering this problem. Then finally, sort of a common offering is that we're all subject, we're all potential defendants in the criminal law, right? And so both the innocent and the guilty at some point have to have, and the way it's often phrased in the literature is the sword of Damocles lifted from over their head. So at some point we have to have the threat of punishment removed from us, right? And this is true both of the innocent and the guilty alike, right? So on the one hand, let's think about the threat that all of us face. So we know that police sometimes make mistakes. We know that it's possible that, you know, I started the talk today mentioning five innocent people who spent somewhere from between 5 and 13 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. So we know the sort of things that happens, and we should take it seriously, right? But I'm not sure as an innocent person what I think we need to do in order to remove that fear for me is to have statutes of limitations. Rather, I'd like to see much better forensic science, right? Much more interest and investment in pursuing better forensic science. I think better interrogation techniques. One of the problems that seems to be associated with things like the Central Park Five and other cases where people are now being exonerated, sort of over-aggressive interrogation from the police, right? So these are the sorts of things, better production of evidence and being a real, very interested in that, like, the law is sort of an epistemological enterprise, I think, is where I would like to see us spend our energy. That might sort of reinstill my faith as far as not being fearful of unjust prosecution, right? And of course, if I'm just sort of fearful of random unjust prosecutions as an innocent person, the statute of limitations doesn't help me at all, right? I mean, because say I'm concerned that there's one particular crime that the police suspect me of, and then that runs out. But that just means there's some new set of crimes I could potentially be accused of now, right? I mean, so like the statute of limitations may help me in one particular instance, right? But I'm not sure, like, if as an innocent person I'm concerned about potential prosecution, I have to be concerned about it coming from anywhere, right? And so the statute of limitations doesn't help me. I'd rather just have better police work in that case, right? So what about the sword of Damocles hanging over the guilty? Well, in this case, I sort of want to throw my hands up in the air and say, well, so much the worse for you. Don't do terrible things, and then you won't live under the sword of Damocles, right? You won't have the fear of punishment hanging over your head. But again, I want to sort of remind you, right, I mean, this is not parking violations that we're talking about. We're interested here in sort of violent assault, rape, you know, these sorts of things. And so, yeah, I sort of have very little sympathy for the... Yeah, but I'll have to live under fear forever. Well, yeah, that's right. You will, right? The state may, eventually your bad actions could catch up with you, right? And so maybe one way to avoid that happening is don't do those terrible things, right? But if you do those terrible things, my inclination is to think so much the worse for you, right? So if that's the objection, that criminals live under, violent criminals will forever live with the fear of being held responsible for their crimes, I'm not sure I see that as a cost. I'm glad to say that's a virtue. All right. So then, very quickly, we may be worried about the issue of stale evidence. Memories fade, right? Eyewitness testimony can be inaccurate, right? So we may hope that our memories operate like a video recording device where we perfectly memorize all of the details and everything that we sort of see in our visual field. But science tells us that's just not how memory operates. That's not how eyewitness testimony operates. Eyewitness testimony, it turns out the things we witness is just incredibly malleable, right? It's subject to like radical revision, radical change, and there's all kinds of fabulous experiments. Nova ran an excellent episode on sort of the malleability of memory a couple months ago, and it's just absolutely fascinating. I suggest you track that down if you have any interest in these sorts of things. But we may think the longer we move out from a crime, the more likely that the evidence is going to become unreliable, right? The memories will fade, memories will change, right? People will become less certain of what they saw, right? And so eventually, the evidence has become so stale that we can't justify pursuing crimes after 6 years, right? I think that's right. So I can't deny the fact that evidence gets stale, but sometimes these, you know, things take place such that we just no longer have reliable evidence such that we can go after violent criminals. I think that's sort of lamentable, but that's the world we happen to live in. However, I think there's all kinds of cases where we have incredibly reliable information that doesn't degrade over time. And when we do have that sort of information, again, the case of the Central Park Five, we had DNA evidence that confirmed that the person who confessed to the sexual assault was guilty of the sexual assault. And that doesn't degrade over time. The DNA evidence was reliable there. And so as a matter of fact, I think in that sort of case, where the evidence hasn't become stale, we are justified, right? It's lamentable that sometimes, right, so prosecutors will not, even if we lift the statute of limitations, prosecutors won't be able to go after every case because not every case will have enough evidence to justify pursuing anyone. But what concerns me are these kinds of cases where we do have excellent evidence that an individual has committed the crime, but because statutes of limitations are in place, we can't go after them. And so stale evidence is a concern, but I think we can build that into the, as it happens now, there's all kinds of cases that haven't gone past the statute of limitations that prosecutors don't pursue because they don't have enough evidence, right? I mean, so this is the world we live in already. It's just making sure that when we do have very good evidence, we have the ability to go after those individuals. All right, so very quickly then, I'll just wrap up. Why are statutes of limitations unnecessary? Well, I think, as I was saying before, we can acknowledge that sometimes time can degrade evidence, right? So we can say, yes, as a matter of fact, there are cases where after a period of time, we shouldn't pursue a prosecution of a violent crime. So when does time sort of justify us? And here I want to turn to another legal doctrine. It's called the doctrine of latches. And so the doctrine of latches essentially says, if you sat on a legal claim for a long time and the delay in pursuing the case wound up producing sort of a prejudicial hindrance to the defendant, the court is capable of dismissing the case, right? So if your delay in bringing the case really prevents the individual from offering their best defense available to them, right, or prejudices their defense, then you can no longer bring the case. And I think the doctrine of latches sort of gets after maybe what the spirit of statutes of limitations was supposed to do in a much better way, right? So imagine Smith says, you know what, I saw Jones on the grassy knoll on the day that JFK was shot and he had a sniper rifle. I think Jones is implicated in the assassination of JFK. We should go after him, right? So the police go and interview Jones, and Jones says, no, I was with my mother all that day. I had nothing to do with that. Smith is crazy. And they say, okay, fine. Let us talk to your mother. And he says, well, my mother's passed away, right? I think that's a case where the passage of time has prejudiced Jones against making a complete defense of himself in that case. And so in that case, we just may have to say, well, look, whether Jones was involved in the assassination of JFK or not, it's just the case that the delay is such that we can no longer fully investigate this. Were Jones' mother still alive, they could go question her, see if there's inconsistency in their story or if their stories hang very well together and make it a better, more informed evaluation of the accusation. But as it stands, all we have is the accusation and the defense has been prejudiced by the delay in bringing this accusation forth. And so in this case, latches says you can't bring the case, right? And so I think that seems much more plausible. So, and latches can kick in 2 years after a crime or 18 years after a crime, right? It's just whether or not the delay has produced some sort of a prejudice against the defendant. And that seems like the much more rational question we should be asking is, has the delay been done such that the individual can no longer actually bring a full and competent defense of themselves? And if it has, I think we should have to take that seriously. All right, then here's my final point, the lurking inconsistency. So the one thing I haven't talked about here is capital punishment or murder. I'm sure actually many of you know, just as I think this is sort of like commonly known, there are no statutes of limitations on murder, right? I mean, but this seems to me cries out for explanation then. This is an inconsistency, right? And so why is it that we have no statute of limitations, but statutes of limitations for violent crimes like assault and rape and these sorts of things? What's the difference, right? None of the sorts of arguments that are typically offered in favor of statutes of limitations are immune or somehow different in the case of murder. murders are prone to evidence going stale. We may worry about prosecutors using the prosecutorial power associated with punishing murders maliciously, all of these sorts of things. But in spite of that fact, we continue to have no statute of limitations with respect to murder. And we may ask why, and I think the very plausible explanation is murder is such a serious and violent crime that we want to be able to pursue murder wherever we see it, right? But if that's true, I don't see why we shouldn't take other really violent, heinous crimes seriously and say, well, those two, for the exact same reason that we have no statute of limitation on murder, should also be immune from statutes of limitations, right? I mean, of course, it's available to one to say, okay, you're right, there's an inconsistency here. Let's kick murder over to the side with statutes of limitations. But essentially the point of the whole, like this whole talk has been, there's not very good reasons for making the move in that direction. It seems much more plausible all the reasons point to moving violent crimes over next to murder where there is no statute of limitations. All right, so I'll hopefully didn't bore you too badly. I'll stop at that point. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to entertain questions then for John. Here's our lawyer friend here. Do you have a question?
With regard to the argument on stale evidence, and I guess to a certain extent latches, the emphasis seemed to be all on the quality of the evidence from the prosecution side. And to me, the bigger issue is the ability of an accused to make a competent defense. You know, if someone accuses me of something I did 2 years ago, you know, there's a better chance I'm able to reconstruct where I am, find the alibi witnesses, find the receipts and all that. If they accuse me of something I did 17 years ago, you know, I may have thrown all that out, and, like your example of the mother being dead. But from my perspective, it's not just a question of, you know, does the prosecution think they have enough evidence to go forward? It's that if the process does go forward, does the defendant really have a reasonable chance? And I do agree that your latches argument, you know, would somewhat get you to the same place. But the question for me on the latches is what is the process for determining if there's been, you know, undue prejudice on the defendant, you know, for doing that? And
I loved your question right up till that moment.
So I mean, I'm a little bit persuaded by the latches argument, but it certainly is indefinite. I mean, it would throw everything into, and it would almost, to me, put a premium on the more elaborate made-up alibis, because if you could completely make up something, you know, like maybe you weren't with your mother, you know, but you know your mother died 5 years ago, so you say, yeah, I was visiting my mom that night, and then I'm more likely to get the fence on latches, where if it's limitation, you know, maybe it doesn't, there's not a premium on kind of coming up with the elaborate fiction.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's great. I mean, so again, I think you're absolutely right. And to some degree, my examples do overemphasize the prosecutorial side, but I think you're absolutely right. We do want to take seriously the fact that we also want to protect people from undue prosecution, right? And so if there has been, you know, such a delay that the individual just can't mount a reasonable defense of themselves, I think we do have to take that seriously. This is what I'm hoping latches can do for us. Now, the very nasty question that you asked is how to sort of make sure that we're applying what constitutes reasonable latches. And so I give sort of like these very, you know, I do some hand waving over there and say, well, you know, like if your mom dies, right, they, you know, and so, but yeah, I mean, that's right. In fact, I was sort of thinking about this the other day, and so maybe the exact case you were offering is, you know, what about these dangers where people just sort of like, once you know how latches operates, you just say, oh, you know what, if you could just talk to Abraham Lincoln, we were hanging out, but, oh, you know, Abe's dead. Oh, I'm so sorry. Right? Yeah, or like just fine. You know, X has died in the interim. X was my alibi. I'm off the hook. So I'll say I'm worried about that, and I do invite that. I do want to be cautious. At this point, I don't really have a very elaborate, well-worked-out explanation about what's going to constitute a reasonable or, you know, prejudicial violation of the individual's ability to mount a defense. What I will say is that I do think that there's some way of making, you know, some headway there, right? So, for instance, again, with the Trisha Mealy case, right? So perhaps the guy who confessed is going to say, well, actually, yeah, so maybe you think it was me, but, you know, I was with my dead mother at the time. But we may think, like, well, that's not ultimately going to really provide any explanation about why your DNA was at the crime scene, right? I mean, so that's ultimately what you have to be able to explain. And so things like your mom, you know, you were with your mom, it's going to, like, there's still going to be that sort of hurdle to overcome. But you want to...
Can I address the DNA? Because I mean,